now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Hauck.
Well, good evening, everybody, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome. You are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding one's courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. In fact, that which you have always been. Very excited to be with you here tonight and every other Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Each and every week, these broadcasts are dedicated to the integration of spirituality and our mental health. And yes, the two go together. But if you look down through the history, somewhere around the Age of Enlightenment, let's say, people wanted to separate spirituality and mental health, or spirituality and science. And, they tried to make cases for that separation, but people are finding more and more these days that the two go hand in hand, that, mental health and science doesn't necessarily explain everything, but what they explain is good. And spirituality picks up and handles matters of the soul. I am Dr. James Hauck, and if you would like more information about me, or if you would like to leave me your comments about tonight's show, please visit our website. It is www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's all one word right there. And if you would like to call in, be part of the show with any questions or comments, that number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after the break. Now, just in case you cannot spend the entire hour with me this evening, no worries. These broadcasts are podcasted now in case you want to go back and listen again, or you can go back into the archives. And you can listen to previous shows, and this and other shows are also available for download on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon Music. Well, for those of you who are tuning in for the very first time, welcome aboard. It's always exciting to have new listeners on. And like I said, if you'd like to call in and just introduce yourself or just say hi, or if you have a question or something, that's fine too. Like I said, I'll be taking your calls after the break. But just want to remind everybody that, each and every one of these broadcasts, that focus is on the integration of our spirituality and our mental health. And that's key right there. It's the integration of these two disciplines. It's an understanding. It's how do we live these out? How do we put these into practice and so on and so forth? As well as when we do this, the more faithful we are to the integration, sooner or later, transformation is inevitable. So this is why I focus on the integration of spirituality and our mental health. And I place it all within the context of our relationships, the relationship that we have with ourselves, the relationship that we have with others, and the relationship that we have with God or the divine. And the reason why I begin with this integration in relationships, because we often receive our deepest physical, emotional, psychological, even spiritual wounds in and through relationships. And perhaps this is one of the reasons why you tuned in tonight, is because you have been wounded in one of these aspects. And yet, however, we can also discover our greatest healing and our strength and our peace and our forgiveness and love through healthier relationships. And ironically, these relationships just might be within our own families. They might be these relationships that we have with our coworkers, colleagues, and friends. But whenever we transform and we are faithful to this integration of mental health and spirituality, like I said, when we transform, we're also going to transform others through our presence, our grace, our understanding. Even if people don't know what to call it, they're going to know that something is different because of the faithfulness to this integration and the just wonderful transformation that comes out in relationships. But, you know, first and foremost, forgiveness and kindness and compassion really begin with how we treat ourselves, because I'm convinced of this, that whenever we are compassionate with ourselves, then we can become more compassionate with others. And whenever we are more forgiving with ourselves, we then can be more forgiving with others. And when we are able to live in gratitude with ourselves, we then discover how this really opens up our hearts to see and live in gratitude with others. So, speaking of courage, it also takes great courage and inner strength to change, to transform from what is known and what is comfortable to something that is fresh, exciting, and new. And again, when we think about it, you know, that which is unknown often contains our greatest potential. And yet, a lot of people get stuck on the fear of the unknown. And yet, to seek that potential by risking change, that is a path of true greatness, because such action brings great favor and untold blessings. And let's be honest with each other, you know, and ourselves. We often do not see courage in ourselves, perhaps because we want to hang on to the past, or maybe we can't even imagine something better in our lives, let alone discovering who we really are as that soul. So in tonight's broadcast, I'm using courage as the strength that we possess that really empowers us to let go of negative attitudes and distorted perceptions that no longer serve us. And those often worn out perceptions, distorted perceptions, often keep us wounded and or victimized. And then taking on something better as a result, more life-giving, more authentic to who we truly are and who we have always been. Or, as my teacher puts it, that until there is an acknowledgement of our spiritual nature as a soul, we will not do the work that is necessary to eradicate this ignorance that keeps us bound. In fact, we're going to continue to experience the ups and downs, the changing joys and sorrows associated with what he calls the temporary and false states of consciousness. And we are going to end up seeking gratifying pleasures that only seek to soothe our sorrows, which, by the way, always brings us back into integrating forgiveness, gratitude, and love in the context of relationships. Okay. So, how is your heart today? I hope that your heart is well. I hope you are well. I hope that if you are struggling today, that perhaps you will be able to find rest in the comfort and the peace that you need. Well, I just want to give a quick shout out to people out there of the Christian faith who are celebrating Holy Week this week. Tomorrow is Maundy Thursday, and Friday is Good Friday. And then, of course, we have Easter. And in the Christian faith, this Holy Week is a time in which people remember the suffering, the betrayal, the denial, the persecution, the crucifixion of Christ, as well as the resurrection that is celebrated on Easter Sunday. So I just want to wish everybody out there a very early happy Easter. Well, in the 70s, if you were around then, if not, you can Google this, or better yet, YouTube it. Back in the 70s, there was a pretty cool rock band called Three Dog Night. Now, Three Dog Night is an American rock band formed in somewhere around 1967, I believe, and they had 21 Billboard Top 40 hits between 1969 and 1975, with three of those hits hitting number one, which were Joy to the World, Mama Told Me Not to Come, and Black and White. Now, my personal favorites, you know, have to be just an old-fashioned love song, Never Been to Spain, and Shambhala. But there was, you know, there one particular song that was very intriguing, namely One. That's all it was called, just One, as in One is the loneliest number you will ever do. And, you know, we have thousands of songs out there, thousands and thousands of songs by bands and groups and individuals singing about being alone and loneliness. And although these tunes are catchy, their messages are all wrong. I mean, you talk about distorted messages. You know, most people I counsel struggle with loneliness. You know, that is being all by themselves and being alone or having little to no friends. But what is it about this tune from Three Dog Night? You know, One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. And that's just not the case, because love is not the loneliest number, because there is tremendous bliss and joy to be found in being one with all things and all people. Okay? But how many of us, you know, through just avoiding the pain and frustration and confusion and letdown in relationships, how many of us, you know, may have pushed our giftedness way down so that others cannot see it? Or maybe we, you know, just believed hook, line, and sinker that people would tell us that you'll never amount to anything. There's nothing good out of you. There's nothing good that's going to come out of where you were born or anything like that. So again, this tonight's show focuses on, yes, the courage to take a look at those things, but also it focuses on the superimposed illusion of these negative beliefs that convince us that we're not connected to everyone and all things. You know, and as I said, it's quite a distorted message out there in music. But in other words, we are one. We have the potential to realize our oneness. Well, let me start things off tonight by just telling you just a very, very familiar story. It's actually a cute little joke, but one day an inspiring Buddhist was practicing her walking meditation in a park. And she was deep in meditation, but she was also able to overhear various conversations from people talking to one another and ordering food during their lunch breaks. Okay. So after listening to these conversations, curiosity got the better of her. So she smiled to herself and walked up to the hot dog vendor, and she wanted to be very clever. So, you know, when he asked her what she wanted, she smiled and she replied, "I want you to make me one with everything." Well, to her surprise, the vendor replied, "Lady, I can't make you one with everything. In fact, nobody can make you anything, because you are already one with everything. You just haven't realized it yet." I mean, a very wise hot dog vendor indeed. And yet, how many of us perceive ourselves as lacking something we already possess? I mean, that's straight out of the Wizard of Oz. You know, that's a great storyline that, you know, Dorothy and her companions go off to see the wizard in order to get something that they had no idea that was already in them. And yet, how many of us also fail to see ourselves for who we truly are, let alone continue the search for that person we truly are and we are becoming? Well, there's another story out there that my India friends are fond of telling me. They love to tell their stories that contain deeper meanings, deeper messages, deeper truths. And this story in particular is called The Princess of Kashi. And it goes like this. Long, long ago, in a kingdom in India, a play was being staged in the royal court. And it was called The Princess of Kashi. Now, the role of the Princess of Kashi was to be played by a little girl. And since there was no little girl in the palace, the queen thought that the prince, who was 5 years old at the time, could be dressed up as a little girl and play that role. Okay. It wasn't a big role, and all the prince had to do was just stand there. And he looked so adorable as a princess that the queen ordered a painting be made of him. And when the painting was done, the artist proudly brushed in the words, "The Princess of Kashi," the bottom, and he dated it. Well, after some years, the painting was taken down to the palace cellar, and it was just stored there. And by now, the prince was a young man of 20 years. He was good-looking, he was confident, he was smart, and he was also being trained in the affairs of the land. Well, one day, while wandering through the palace, he found a set of stairs leading to this cellar, and he decided to explore what was in there. And so, as he was walking around, he found this painting of a little girl dressed up in royal garb, and underneath was written, "The Princess of Kashi." And looking at the date, he realized that the princess in the painting would be the same age as he was. And she was so pretty that the prince immediately fell in love with her. And he decided that he would marry nobody else but her. And like any young man in love, he became dreamy and preoccupied with the thoughts of the Princess of Kashi. He lost his focus on his princely activities and responsibilities, and so on and so forth. But by now, the king and queen had noticed a change in his mood and behavior, and they were becoming quite concerned. And they asked him what was wrong, but he was just simply too shy to let them know. Well, finally, a kind old court minister met the prince, and he asked him, "Dear prince, what's wrong? Why are you not yourself these days?" And after gently reassuring the prince that he would keep his secret, the court minister was able to coax a reply out of the prince. "I'm in love," said the prince bashfully. "Oh, that's great news," said the court minister. "Who is she? Where is she?" "Well, she's the Princess of Kashi. I saw a painting of her in the royal cellar. The date of the painting shows that she would be 20 years old, just like me, and I want to marry her." Well, on hearing these words, the court minister became silent, and he started to think. He knew he had heard of the Princess of Kashi before, but he couldn't remember where and when. So he asked the young prince, "Can you please show me this painting?" And the prince took him down to the royal cellar, and when the court minister saw the painting, he immediately recognized who the princess was. And placing his hand on the prince's shoulder, the kind-hearted court minister looked him in the eye and said in a serious tone, "Dear prince, I have something to tell you. You can't marry this girl." "Well, why not?" the prince asked. "Is she already married? Is she dead?" Well, the minister then told him the story of the play that was staged 15 years ago and how he, the prince, was dressed up as a girl and made to play the role of the Princess of Kashi. "Dear prince, you can't marry her because you are also the Princess of Kashi." Well, the prince was in shock and he was bewildered as he heard the minister's words. And on realizing the truth that the Princess of Kashi didn't exist and that he himself was what he was yearning for, his desire for the princess melted away. So let's wrap this up with the moral of the story. In other words, he realized he was already one with the person in the picture. He just didn't realize it yet. He didn't understand the connectedness he had from the beginning, and he kept seeing himself separate from the person in the picture. Well, we run into this time and time again simply because we don't realize that we're already one but for some reason we see ourselves as separate. And oh yeah, we can talk about a shared humanity, but our connectedness is a soul-to-soul connection. The problem is, we have to realize this first and foremost in ourselves. So the question for us then is just, how well do we know ourselves? You know, ironically, one of the most important questions we ask ourselves at least twice, if not more, in our lives is this question, who am I? Now, according to developmental psychologists out there, you know, we first begin asking these questions when we're somewhere around 4 years old in terms of, who am I? You know, I am a boy. I have this. She's a girl. She has that. I have a body. I have hair and so forth. And we ask this question in terms of self-discovery of who we are when we look into a mirror. Now, the second time we ask this question is somewhere in our early 20s, you know, only this time, who am I has to do more with an internal self-discovery of how we want to live our lives. You know, in other words, what morals and values that we've been raised with, and now which ones do we want to keep? What's really important to me? And what are some things that are not so much, and so forth? So how well do we really know ourselves? Well, knowing who we are is probably where most people struggle to understand striving to be one with everything. Oneness, on a certain level, has to do more with understanding how we are connected to all people and all things. I mean, for example, let's say that we want to add sugar to our morning coffee. Okay. And being one with everything doesn't mean that we actually become the sugar that we put in our coffee, but rather we are connected to the sugar in terms of the people who have supplied the sugar to the store and all of the employees who work there, as well as we're also connected to the growers who planted and harvested the sugar cane, which will eventually become the sugar we add to our coffee. And out of this awareness of just how we are connected to those who put food on our table or sugar for our coffee, out of this awareness comes a sense of deep gratitude and respect for all that we have received through the hard work and effort of others. So realizing our oneness or connection with all things, we ought to never take for granted anything in our lives, but rather it should cultivate in us a deep sense of gratitude, a deep sense of compassion for all people who supply things that we use every day. So everything then is seen as a gift. And this makes much more sense, whether or not we realize that we're connected to everyone and all things, directly or indirectly. Yeah, it's kind of like the game 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon, where you try to follow the connection of Kevin Bacon to other actors and entertainers or producers or anybody else in the business. So when you think about it, we are interconnected to all things and all people in a universal awareness. But oneness and connectedness in the spiritual sense goes much, much deeper because it involves who we are at our core rather than who we know. Well, if you were with me during the last podcast, I was talking about that when it comes to wrestling with life's questions, many people are often overwhelmed not only by this concept that the answers they often seek lie within themselves, as well as the belief that inner peace and freedom and joy and unconditional love just might be all too good to be true, that those things belong to somebody else. But the truth is that we do possess this key, let's say, to unlock our doors to an inner freedom, grace, and peace like we have never known before. So again, the question becomes, how open am I to wanting to really know who I am? In fact, you know, whether it is within Western or Eastern cultures, when we are ready, effective teachers, mentors, leaders throughout history have been characterized by those who help pull out of others the very best of themselves. So when a student is ready, absolutely, the teacher will appear. But still, there are many people out there that I run into who, out of ignorance or fear, would rather live in, you know, their grief and pain and sorrow. I know it's just, it's baffling at times, but that's what they choose. Because you see, for many, they're just not ready to let go of their wounds and embrace the possibility that they can live in forgiveness. They can live in gratitude, and ultimately they can live in love for themselves and for others. But you know, this is where the term emotional and psychological self-inflicted wounds come from. So think about it this way. We think that if we say something harmful or if we do something harmful, that it will never come back on us. But it does. Every negative thought, every negative thing we say, every negative thing we do comes back to us, often reinforcing the wounded parts of ourselves. And we have many ways to understand this concept. You know this if you've been listening to me for some time. You know, we'll say what goes around comes around. Or for some people, they say what you sow, you're going to reap. And even karma is another way to understand that no matter how you say it, humanity lives in an echo, that whatever goes out from us will return to us, just like we hear the sound of our own voice echoing back in our ears if we shout in a cave or a tunnel. So everything we think, everything we say, everything we do is energy. And unless we transform the energy first by healing ourselves and healing our own woundedness, it's going to come back to us exactly how it went out from us. And as I mentioned, this is a phenomenon I run into time and time again, counseling clients who want to heal from their past and improve their relationships. That's great. But whatever a person is struggling with from other relationships, more likely is also struggling with the same issue in themselves. So what negative energy is being sent out will echo back sooner or later. So, for example, let's say a person who is filled with bitterness from a previous hurt or betrayal will more than likely view everything and feel everything from a lens of bitterness. And let's say a person who has experienced tremendous hurt from a broken trust in relationship, unless this is healed and transformed, more than likely, this person will view everything and everyone with a level of suspicion. And this is very difficult for people to understand this, you know, the phenomena of emotional and psychological self-inflicted wounds. So just keep in mind, what goes out has first come from within. So you might hear a person say, you know, I'm never going to forgive that person for, which usually means I'll never be able to forgive myself for, or maybe you've heard, I can never trust another person because, which usually means I have difficulty trusting myself. And maybe you've also heard a person say, can't stand it when a person says or does this. It usually means I can't stand myself when I say or do this. Or the classic, I just can't love that person because, usually means I also struggle with loving myself. Well, I would really love to hear your heart on this subject. So if you would like to call in, that number is 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. Be back with you in 1 minute. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Again, I'm Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Well, earlier in the show, I was talking about connectedness, oneness, in the story of the Princess of Kashi. It's a story my India friends love to tell time and time again, you know, and whenever they get a chance to tell it, you know, I'm like, yeah, go ahead. I've heard it 1,000 times, but I love the way they tell the story. And the story is about a prince. When he was about 5 years old, he was dressed up like a girl in order to play a part in a palace play. He then posed for a painting, which was labeled as the Princess of Kashi. The painting was then hidden away in a cellar, which he found some 15 years later. Now, he immediately fell in love with the girl in the painting, believing that she was probably the same age as him. But a wise court minister exposed the truth that who he really fell in love with was himself. So, in other words, his error was that he believed he was separate from the girl in the picture. But the truth was that he and the girl in the picture were one and the same person. He just didn't realize it. He didn't understand his connectedness that he had from the beginning, as he kept seeing himself separate from the person in the picture. And this is where we often see ourselves as being separate from everybody else and all things. And this would be true if all we did was focus on the externals, you know, but what if we allowed ourselves to see one another as souls? Then we would understand the oneness or the connection that we have with others regarding, you know, race and class and creed and culture and stereotypes and prejudices and stigmas and language. And this is all the more reason why it's important to see the divine in everybody. So when we are ready, God certainly opens up for us a profound understanding of who we are as souls. And when we look at each other as souls, we soon discover and we see ourselves as a soul. And we begin to realize that the externals do not matter in the least. So in other words, there is no more sexism. There is no more racism. There is no more ageism. There are simply no more isms, because they cannot hold up to the standard that we are all souls, or that we are all children of light, or that we are all droplets of water returning to the ocean. And we are no different from one another, albeit the externals. So why then do we have the externals, and why are we on earth as an embodied soul? Well, some people would say that we're an embodied soul because of the karma, because of what our soul still needs to work out in terms of the lessons that are learned, you know, and the healing that needs to take place. And we're often reminded of the wounds and the habits or the choices or whatever that we had made or need to make to work out that karma. Well, Anthony DeMello was one of those spiritual teachers and mentors who always sought to empower others and to bring them to higher states of self-awareness and self-discovery. And he often told a story to illustrate that we can let go of former things in order to take hold of something better. He tells the story of a villager in India who happened upon a sannyasi. Now, a sannyasi is a wandering enlightened one who, having attained enlightenment, understands that the whole world is his home, and that the sky is his roof, and that God will look after him. So he moves from place to place, the way you and I would move from one room of our home to another. And I cannot believe this, the villager says to the sannyasi when their paths crossed. And the sannyasi says, "What is it that you cannot believe?" "Well," said the villager, "I had a dream about you last night. I dreamt that the Lord said to me, tomorrow morning, you will leave the village around 11 o'clock, and you will run into this wandering sannyasi. And here, I've met you. Well, what else did the Lord say to you? Asked the sannyasi. And the villager replied, he said to me, if the man gives you a precious stone he has, you will be the richest man in the world. Dear sir, would you give me that stone? Well, the sannyasi tells the villager to wait a minute, and he starts to rummage through his knapsack, and he retrieves an object. Would this be the stone you're talking about? The sannyasi asked, handing it to the villager. Well, the villager could not believe his eyes. It was the largest diamond in the world. And he stands there, he holds the diamonds in his hand, and he asked, could I have this? Of course, said the sannyasi. Take it. I found it near the river. You're welcome to it. And the villager, he this diamond, and he went to sit under a tree on the outskirts of the village, where he clutches this diamond to his heart, and he experiences great joy. Kind of like the joy we experience when we finally get something we really want. And do we ever stop to ask how long that's going to last? Not really. But still, let's say we finally got the girl we wanted, right? Or you got the boy you wanted. Or you finally got that car that you've been saving up for. You got the degree. You were the top of your class, or so on and so forth. You got the promotion. Same thing. Yet how long does that joy last? How many seconds? How many minutes? I mean, eventually we get tired of it, don't we? And then we're off looking for something else. Well, this villager sat under the tree all day, clutching this diamond, this deliriously happy. And he became immersed in thought. And toward evening, he went down to the river where the sannyasi was meditating. And he gives him back this diamond. And the sannyasi looked perplexed. And the villager said, Master, could you do me one more favor? Well, what is it? Asked the sannyasi. Could you give me the inner riches that makes it possible for you to so easily give away this thing that would have made you the richest man in the world? Letting go of former things in order to take hold of something better. Think about it. If we're capable of sending out negative energy from unresolved, say, emotional and physical and psychological and spiritual wounds, then we certainly can also send out through our thoughts, our words, and our actions, positive energy. Positive energy that gives life. Positive energy that gives healing and grace. Because they come from those places of woundedness that have been healed and transform. Still, you know, there's a lot of talk these days about reducing our carbon footprints from eliminating greenhouse gases and industrial emissions and the effects of mining to global warming debate and conservation. And yet, as I listen to these conversations and these debates, what I don't hear in these conversations is how damaging the effects our carbon footprints clearly have and how they mimic the damaging effects of our interpersonal footprints have on one another. Because sadly today, it's often considered the norm, if not the expectation, that people will walk all over one another, that it's a guarantee that people will just simply lie, they'll cheat, they'll steal. And then they expect that these actions will have no psychological or spiritual or emotional or even physical consequences. And if we assume this, we are gravely mistaken. As evidenced from our attitudes and our actions, we've not learned from previous generations' discoveries and mistakes. I mean, we clearly do not possess the ancient wisdom that comes from recognizing those lessons of respect and dignity and value and gratitude passed on to us in the created order of things. So let's put it another way. It ought to be glaringly obvious that the way we treat our environmental resources and animals is a direct reflection of our attitudes and behaviors towards each other. In fact, despite all of our searching for psycho-spiritual wholeness, we don't possess that wisdom because we do not understand how we are spiritually and emotionally fragmented. And yet it's from this understanding that we recognize the opportunity that is before us to heal our relationships to ourselves, to heal relationships to others and the land. Now, for those who seek a heightened psycho-spiritual awareness, mountains have a lot to teach us about the interpersonal with God and others and intrapersonal with ourselves relationships. And for those of you who love to hike mountains, you know, standing at the base of a mountain, these mountains remind us just how small we are in comparison. And yet as we hike or we climb, we are struck by the beauty and splendor of life that surrounds us. And upon reaching the summit, many people sense a stronger connection to themselves and to God, as well as, you know, perceiving a greater perspective of the world below. And in those moments, we have a greater awakening of how our uniqueness has been gifted by God, as well as our growing edges and vulnerable areas we have yet to surrender to God. So in this sense, we are overcome with a sense of gratitude and understanding. Even though we may not know what we might discover about ourselves, people continue to seek God with the help of mountains. I mean, how many mountaintop retreats have you been on? How many treks have you been on? My favorite mountain is Bear Butte in South Dakota. Love, love it, love it, love it. And if you've ever read my book, Reclaiming Authenticity, I mention several mountains in there, but I go into great detail about Bear Butte and just why that became very special to me. So we still are fascinated, just as human beings, with mountains and, you know, seeking God on mountaintops and so forth. But, you know, moreover, whatever we experience, you know, can also be a powerful psycho-spiritual transformation that leaves us unlike we were before. And herein lies the irony of humanity, that history has demonstrated how some people are only drawn to mountains to extract their minerals, but not drawn to the people. So, in other words, people will often sell their souls for all the natural resources that they can produce, while at the same time throwing away the most important resource of all, namely relationships. And this psycho-spiritual disconnection is something that the land doesn't forget, because the land indeed remembers. I'm convinced of it. Souls and souls and souls have trekked land for countless generations. The air they breathed is the same air we breathe. The same sources of water from which they drank, we drink. The same mountains they've climbed for their psycho-spiritual renewal, we climb today. These literal and spiritual paths have been blazed for us to follow, and our imprint does not go unnoticed. So as we walk in the footprints of our ancestors and our relations, as a great cloud of witnesses, they carefully observe our attitudes and actions. Yes, the land remembers through the countless violence and aggression throughout history in which the stain of blood is communicated. I mean, even the blood of those who've laid slain cry out from the lamp, which is imprinted with the horrors of genocide and desolation. We may attempt to try to forget about these tragedies as the so-called history books are written from a softer perspective that romanticizes the harsh reminders of a depraved humanity. But to put it another way, it ought to be glaringly obvious that the way we treat the land is how we treat one another. But we are spiritually and emotionally fragmented. And yet, as I mentioned before, it's from this understanding that we recognize a great opportunity that's before us to heal our relationships, to heal ourselves and heal others and heal the land. And it's through this that the land remembers, through the countless violence and aggressions throughout history, the land remembers. And yet the echoes of pain and suffering tell us that their stories need to be heard and told. Or as one Lakota man put it, "I listen to the screams of the wounded and the dying carried on the wind across the prairie. Blood spilled in the ground. We forget about all these things, but the trees, they remember. The rocks, they remember. And the earth, it remembers. They remember when we forget. The story is forever imprinted on this land. And if we listen, they will guide us. They will give us visions. They will tell us stories. Past, present, and future all touch one another. Time does not exist. For spirits, time does not exist. So can you hear them? Can you hear their cries?" Well, in talking to others who have climbed mountains and listened to its ancient wisdom, some people find their experience similar to different parts of a symphony. At one point in a symphony, the music begins softly, and then it swells to this heart-beating crescendo. And the melody carries us along till we find ourselves at the very height of its music, when the sound of, let's say, cymbals crash and the timpani thunders a vibration in our hearts and in our throats. And we feel our spirits lifted in that moment, almost as if, as though we've been taken to a higher, better place outside of ourselves. And so, magically transformed, it's within this atmosphere of sound where we want to stay because these feelings are so euphoric. And perhaps it's within this moment of sound that we are able to transcend something in ourselves that we have been unable to do by any other means. And yet, just as quickly as there is a crescendo, there's also a descent, bringing our feet back down to earth, back down to the everyday sounds of traffic, conversations, machines, and relationships. Still, we tell ourselves we've been on a great journey for a moment. We want to stay there for as long as possible. And the music that we heard carries us through as we leave the concert hall or the auditorium or the theater. And it is this distant memory of music that we keep trying to get back to. We want that same feeling over and over again. And just as we have to leave the concert hall or the auditorium, we also have to come down from the mountain and live out our lives in relationships of what we have encountered. If we have not invested time and authenticity in relationships, we are going to find ourselves disconnected, emotionally empty, and spiritually emaciated as the land itself has been stripped of its resources. And sooner or later, we have to return to our daily routines and we have to discover new ways to live out our transformative experiences. And as much as we may have experienced this exhilarating psycho-spiritual transformation, the irony is that these life-changing moments are not necessarily for ourselves. Because indeed, just as strong as the experience of this psycho-spiritual transformation is, we're then called to transcend these mountaintop experiences by getting beyond our self-serving attitudes or our codependent behaviors and embrace our mutually shared connection to one another. There's also a power of reflection and surrender and forgiveness and sowing the seeds of growth. We are one. We live in oneness. We just don't realize it yet. We have to be mindful of our thoughts. We have to be mindful of our words. We have to be mindful of our actions. Because as those things come out from us, they're going to return to us. So if we send out negative energy in terms of wounding others, we're going to wound ourselves or keep ourselves wounded. But if we're able to send out healing and love and grace and gratitude and patience and forgiveness, well, that transformative life will also return to us, blessing us. So as Paulo Coelho says, that the energy of hate will take you nowhere, but the energy of forgiveness, which manifests through love, will manage to change your life in a very positive sense. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Join me again in 2 weeks on Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, for another Reclaiming Authenticity broadcast right here on bbsradio.com. Take care, and have a happy Easter.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding around to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, on BBS Radio TV.